Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. It's even colder than last week and more snow to boot in some places. Hope you're home, safe, and warm. Coming up later in today's program, we've got a story from Side Effects Public Media, also Dayton Youth Radio. Up first, the Dayton Food Bank is reporting an uptick in new clients seeking emergency food assistance as the partial government shutdown continues into its fourth week. Federal lawmakers recently approved a measure giving affected workers back pay when the government reopens. In this conversation with Jess Mador, Food Bank spokesperson Laura Davenport says furloughed federal workers and contractors have been living without a paycheck since before the Christmas holidays, and many are having trouble feeding their families.
The government shutdown has affected the food assistance in three different ways. The first way is those who have been furloughed, all the federal employees that have not been receiving paychecks for the past, it's going on 4 weeks now. Those who are unable to receive their paychecks, they are spread thin to make sure all of their bills are paid. So we are seeing that some are coming to our food pantries in need of food assistance. The second way that we are seeing food assistance being affected is through the SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, formerly known as food stamps. With SNAP assistance, people who are enrolled in the program, they receive a monthly amount of money to be able to buy food from grocery stores. Through the USDA's Secretary Perdue, he was able to lengthen it so that people have money for February, but it is put onto their SNAP card today, which is January 16th. That means that they're not going to get any more in February because they're getting it right now. Those who receive SNAP food assistance, they will have to make sure that they budget really well, or they're going to see that in February. And then after February, they are not going to be receiving any assistance through SNAP until the government reopens if the shutdown lasts that long. If that happens, of course, there are pantries in the area who can help them out, fulfill their needs. That's what they're here for.
So what is your message to people who might be in that situation? I mean, obviously, if you're qualifying for SNAP, you're on a really low budget. And if you are a furloughed worker, federal worker who hasn't been paid in 4 weeks, are people coming and asking for information?
Yes. For anybody who is in need of food assistance or they're seeing that their SNAP food money is running out before they're able to get back on their feet, then they can always contact the food bank. We have a helpline that people can call and we can connect them to a food pantry in their area. That assistance number is 937-238-5132. I mean, we're here to help to make sure that nobody falls through those cracks, and because everybody deserves to be able to have the ability to get food. As this shutdown continues, we're going to see more and more snowball effect of how it's going to be affecting people through food assistance and other ways. And with food assistance, we want to make sure that people know that there are resources out there that are available so that they're not just trying to make something come out of thin air. But we also need to make sure that we're letting our legislators know that it's really important that we can reopen the government so people don't have to make these kinds of decisions of whether they're going to eat tonight or not.
Is there anything else you want to add?
So the food bank receives food through the USDA, and we'll be able to receive food through March if the government shutdown lasts through that. But after that, we won't be receiving food until the government reopens. With that, we also usually receive reimbursements to cover the funding of gas for transportation of the food that we receive through the USDA, all of the storage costs for freezer and cooler. And right now, we are shouldering all of that cost, which is about $14,000 a month.
That's a lot. Do you have any communication from the government right now?
We're receiving information from the USDA, from Feeding America, which is a national organization, and then also through the Ohio Association of Food Banks. They're keeping us in the loop about what's going on a state level and also a national level. And we're receiving updates once or twice a week.
Thanks again for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Happy to help.
the food bank's Laura Davenport speaking with WISO's Jess Mador. I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WISO Weekend. Thanks again for joining us. Dayton housing officials also say the government shutdown has stalled critical affordable housing development in the city. Among the federal agencies closed by the shutdown is the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, the agency that funds low-income housing, including the rental voucher program, commonly known as Section 8. Greater Dayton Premier Management's Kaya Patrick says Dayton landlords are still being paid and tenants have not yet been affected, but she says if the shutdown continues into March, it could affect financing for new housing developments.
We are feeling the effects because we are just kind of in limbo. So for some of our deals, they're held up. We can't close them because we're waiting for HUD staff to return to work. And so we're concerned about how that would affect our future ability to attract equity investors in new affordable housing projects.
The agency currently has more than 100 units of new affordable housing moving through the approval process. And, of course, continuing in the news this week, addiction devastates millions of Americans, and shaking off its grip is extremely hard. Last year, Side Effects Public Media asked people in recovery to share their stories at a live event in Indianapolis. You'll hear some of them in a series of theirs that we'll bring you called Sober, Voices of Recovery and Hope. People in addiction recovery will sometimes talk about a moment of clarity that led to their sobriety. For 48-year-old Nathan Boyer, that moment came after he fell off a ladder and his wife checked him into rehab.
Hello, my name is Nathan and I'm an alcoholic. I'm 48 years old, and if I live to be 100, I'm never going to stop being amazed that I can say that out loud and even with a little bit of pride. I've been sober now a little over 4 years, which means I was a practicing alcoholic from the ages of 14 through 44, but I was probably born one. I just wasn't lucky enough to get that first drink till I was an adolescent. I've struggled with pretty bad anxiety my whole life. Of course, in the 70s, there wasn't really anybody around to tell that to me or explain it to me. All I knew, I was scared and lonely all the time. Alcohol is excellent at reducing anxiety, short term. And I did this during a period of life where you're supposed to be developing healthy social skills and coping mechanisms. But I just skipped all that. And the teenage worries about anxiety turn into grown-up worries, like finances and careers, real love and family commitments. And that sort of thing gives healthy people anxiety. I didn't have a clue how to deal with any of it, at least not sober. And in addition to that, a little bit wasn't really going a very long way anymore, just like any chemical addiction. What started out as every weekend when I was at a party turned into every few days, which turned into first thing every morning. I regularly drove my grade school-aged children around when I was hammered. My wife, who loved me very much indeed, was on the verge of leaving me. Back in 2012, I lost my job because I was drunk at the office. I had worked at that company for 16 years and had been climbing the corporate ladder, but oh well. A really astounding thing, in my mind, my drinking still wasn't the problem. Then, in the spring of 2014, I had my moment. My 13-year-old daughter had been in a musical at school. And I volunteered to help break down the sets and stuff when everything was done because I'm so altruistic. So I showed up at school with my power tools and a pretty good drunk on, like most days. So I'm taking the roof off of a false storefront, and I fall off of a 10-foot ladder to the stage. And I bust my head open. I broke and dislocated my right shoulder, and I broke several ribs. And I did this in front of my 13-year-old daughter, and her friends, and their parents, and her teachers. So, 2 days later, my wife checks me into a rehab facility. And honestly, I didn't think for a minute that I was starting a program of recovery. The way I looked at it, my problem was unique, right? No one could possibly understand, let alone help. But as it turns out, I was wrong. There are an awful lot of people that understand exactly what I was going through that have been where I was. And once I took the alcohol out of the equation, I addressed the anxiety issues with therapy and medication that works if you don't wash it down with vodka. And I found out that I can be the man that I always wanted to be. I am still the man my wife fell in love with. I'm a better father than I ever was, and I'm just a better person in general. And these are all qualities in me that I've had my entire life but was never able to see on my own. And I hope telling this story lets somebody out there that has no hope, that doesn't see possibility, somebody that is too broken to fix, do something about it. But if you're anything like me, you'll probably have to fall off your own ladder.
That story was produced by Matt Pelser for Side Effects Public Media, a news collaborative covering public health in the Midwest. This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. Fathers and sons can have different types of relationships that can go on to impact future generations of a family. In today's Dayton Youth Radio story, a teenage son introduces us to his dad. Here's project coordinator Basim Blunt.
Zulik Johnson of Ponence High School spends time with his father in a man cave. It's covered with Cincinnati Bengals memorabilia. A team his father has never given up on.
Three strong quarters on defense against the Steelers last week.
Dad, come here.
Please think better. Tell us from AJ Green.
AJ Green right now.
Who played better for the Bengals?
Me and my dad have a man cave. The Bengals is my dad's favorite team, so it's Bengals everything. Bengals posters, Bengals rugs, to Bengals clocks. The calendar even has Bengals on it. The Bengals are doing very terrible this year, like always.
Jacksonville could beat the Bengals.
So?
But my dad still always has faith.
Right, beat Jacksonville. Get down, get
down. I have an interesting name. It's spelled Z-U-L-E-K, and some people pronounce it Zulik, but the way it's pronounced is Zulik. I was named after my mother, whose name is Zulima, and her name comes from an African tribe, Zulu, and it means beautiful. My story is about my dad growing up without his father. It was a big impact on his life. He didn't have a fun childhood. My father went to work to help my grandmother pay the bills. He had to learn how to play sports on his own. When you're living in an urban city like Dayton, Ohio, on the west side, you go get into a couple of fist fights growing up. And my father had to learn that on his own as well. And he had to learn how to do a lot of things that my grandmother couldn't teach him. My father plays a big part in our life. A lot of my friends don't have that father in their life. They can come to my house and see my dad, and sometimes they even call him Pops. We just laugh and joke about it. My father's dream was to have a family. You know, something you will see on TV. A two-parent household with maybe two or three kids and a dog. When we were little, me and my siblings used to ask my dad, where's his father? He used to jokingly say he got hit by a Bud Light truck crossing the street to get some beer. Then when we got older, he told us the real story. My dad was 9 years old, and he was fixing him a bowl of cereal, and it wasn't no milk in the refrigerator. My dad's father told him that he was going to get some milk, which was right down the street, and he went to go get some milk, but he never returned.
How did that make you feel?
I didn't think about it. My mom took care of all that, so she was the mom and dad, so I didn't think about it that much.
I honestly don't think my dad was telling the truth because my grandmother had shown me a picture of what my grandfather looks like. My dad didn't like that at all. He was furious. If my grandfather was to walk into my house, my dad would probably kick him out and tell him never return. A father and a son relationship can go on. If you have a strong relationship with your father, then it will be much easier to be helped raised as a man. I mean, there are some strong mothers out there, but I don't think that a mother can do it all. You know, it's certain things that a father has to teach their son. My father taught me a lot. He taught me how to tie a tie, how to play basketball, football. You know, he taught me how to treat my mother right, how to talk to girls. A mother can have a couple of words in that, but the father got to be the one with the swag, with the style. You know, you got to tell him, you know, you got to approach him like this and approach him like that. I think that's a role for a father. A father and a son relationship can go on forever. I believe if you have a strong relationship with your father, then it will be much easier to be helped raised as a man. And this is Alik Johnson for Day and Youth Radio, for Ponit CTC.
That was Boys to Men, written and produced by Zalik Johnson, a senior at Ponit's Career Technology Center. Special thanks to Joanne Viscup and Jeffrey Crowell. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basim Blunt.
Support for Dayton Youth Radio comes from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation and the Ohio Arts Council. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. In today's bulletin board diaries, a business card found on a bulletin board at a Lebanon restaurant leads us to a horse barn in Franklin. Check it out.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm Christina.
Christina. Jerry.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Inside the barn in Franklin, stalls run the length of both sides. In one stall, three tiny baby goats announce their presence while huddling together in a pile of hay. On the other side of the barn are the two horses that Christina Green is here to see. Christina is a farrier specializing in what's called barefoot trimming. That means she cares for the hooves of horses who don't wear iron horseshoes. She also cares for donkeys, mules, and small livestock animals. Farriers as a profession have been organized for about 700 years. One of the horses Christina will work on today is Hank, a big brown horse with hooves the size of dinner plates.
Okay. Hi, Hank. Good boy. So Hank is a draft horse.
Beautiful.
Yep. He is 25 years old, so they just got a couple months ago, and he's still trying to gain weight. That's why he looks the way he does.
Oh, okay.
Hank is essentially a rescue horse. He should weigh about 2,000 pounds, but when his new owners found him, he was at least 500 pounds underweight.
Okay, now Hank is almost completely blind, and was it right eye, I believe? So sometimes he wants to walk around and do things. I have to let him know I am here.
Starting with one of Hank's back legs, Christina begins her work.
So you just kind of ask them for their leg by touching it, petting it, reassuring them you're not going to yank on them and make them fall over. Hang up. Hang up. Like that. Good boy. Okay, easy. Stand.
Once Hank is ready, Christina places his leg hoof side up in a sturdy metal stand. She cleans and trims the frog. That's the triangular center of the hoof. Then she trims and balances the hoof wall and file finishes the bottom and side edges. Christina is basically giving Hank a supersized mani-pedi, but what she's doing is actually more about the horse's health than making his hooves look nice.
Hoof down. Everyone. He's like, nope. Not today.
Horse hoofs are made from a tough protein called keratin, the same material that human nails and hair are made of. The hooves grow, and so they need to be trimmed and kept even to prevent balance issues. The hooves also carry a lot of weight and need to be kept healthy.
Wild horses do not have to have their hooves trimmed because they do it themselves. They travel about 25 miles a day. They don't have to worry about human interference helping them.
Christina is 27 years old. Her long, wavy blonde hair is pulled back in a ponytail. In blue jeans and a sweater, she also sports thick rubber boots and a pink apron. Not the kitchen variety. This apron is more like the chaps worn by bull riders. On her hands, a pair of tough leather gloves.
Good boy. Good.
Christina likes to talk to the animals as she works. She says it helps keep them calm.
So that someone actually cares.
Hank's trimming takes a while because of his age and past neglect. A foul smell emanates from an infected hoof as Christina cleans out the dirt and other debris. She tells me it's improved since her last visit, but it's clearly still causing Hank distress.
Bearing down today.
The horse pulls his leg back, knocking over the stand, defiantly stomping his hoof in protest. Christina comforts Hank and deftly continues with her job.
It's a lot of work. It really is. I mean, if you don't mind being dirty or being kicked or coming home smelling like horses, it's a great job. It's not going to faint a heart, though.
This career path has come as a bit of a surprise for Christina, who says she didn't grow up on a farm and only started riding horses at the age of 20. She learned the farrier trade after getting a horse of her own and has been doing the work for about 6 years.
The most I've ever trimmed one day, which I regret, is 15. 15 full horses. It's a lot of work, and you're just a leave, a hot shower, 10 hours of sleep, and you should be fine, but sometimes it takes more than a day to rebound from it.
Christina currently cares for roughly 160 animals and says she develops a close bond with most of them.
I really care about my horses that I trim. They're not mine, but I try to get to know them. So every horse has their own strengths and weaknesses, their own personality. And sometimes you become attached, you know, they're not yours. It's like, worst part about being a farrier, you get a call saying the horse passed away.
With Hank and Joe back in their stalls, Christina packs up her tools and sits down on the barn floor. In a notebook, she writes down the condition of the horses she spent time with, notes the work she performed, and schedules her next visit. She'll be back in about 6 weeks to do this all over again. For WISO's Bulletin Board Diaries, I'm Jerry Kenney. Well, it's been a long road back to the head of the Ohio House for Larry Householder. The former speaker became the new speaker in a controversial vote, and he's the first person in 60 years to become speaker for a second time. As State House correspondent Karen Kassler reports, he's being described as a masterful politician with a combination of down-home charm and calculating shrewdness.
I'm deeply honored to be the leader of this House, the People's House.
That was Larry Householder on January 3, 2001, just after he was unanimously elected Speaker. The conservative Perry County Republican, with the folksy demeanor and a touch of Southern Ohio twang, took over for Speaker Joanne Davidson, who had planned to turn the gavel over to the late Bill Harris of Ashland. But Householder lobbied Republicans in contested primaries and got enough support to beat Harris, who ended up being appointed to the Senate and eventually became its president. That line is just one thing that's echoed in Householder's return to the dais a little over 14 years later, after a vote in a sharply divided House.
This truly is the people's House. We want this place to be accessible. It is our tool to use. We're going to use it the very best way that we can.
Householder, who's in his second term, ousted Ryan Smith, who'd been Speaker for 7 months. Smith had been the likely choice to succeed term-limited Speaker Cliff Rosenberger. But reports of an FBI investigation into bribery and extortion involving payday lending lobbyists led to Rosenberger's resignation in April and Smith's early election as Speaker in June. Householder didn't run then, but used both the Rosenberger scandal and, once again, contested primaries to boost his campaign for Speaker. Term limits had forced Householder out in 2004. Longtime Republican lawmaker Bill Seitz says he encouraged Householder to come back to the State House, saying he passed big legislation such as the first concealed carry weapons law and the Defense of Marriage statute, and even a hike in the gas tax.
That's a controversial thing, but it got done. So he's an excellent judge of talent, personally very charming, very, very keen political instincts. And, you know, a lot got done in that period from 01 to 04 under rather trying circumstances.
Representative Seitz voted for Ryan Smith for Speaker, saying that traditionally, whoever won the informal caucus vote would be supported in the official vote on the floor. And Smith did win a majority of Republican votes. But Householder won overall with an even tally of votes from Republicans and Democrats, though he left no doubt in a primary ad campaign in May where he stands on certain issues.
I'm a pro-gun, pro-life Christian conservative, and I have the highest NRA rating in Ohio's history.
One of the 26 Democrats who voted for Householder is veteran lawmaker David Leland of Columbus.
Speaker Householder did a better job of reaching out to Democrats. I don't think there was much of an attempt by the other side to reach out to Democrats, which I think bodes well for the future of the House, because if he realizes there are two parties and that we need to have a bipartisan solution to Ohio's problems.
Householder pledged in his first remarks as Speaker that Democrats would co-chair some subcommittees and that he was open to more discussion of amendments. And union groups had pushed Democrats to support Householder, who they say has promised to halt anti-union measures, though some Republicans who voted for Householder are strong supporters of so-called right-to-work legislation. Householder will have a new Democratic leadership team to work with, now that Minority Leader Fred Strayhorn of Dayton and Whip Bridget Kelly of Cincinnati, who both supported Smith, have resigned those positions. As he was building his support, Householder also had to return thousands of dollars in improper county Republican Party donations. But there have been no charges. In 2006, there were also no charges from an FBI investigation into allegations of bribery and corruption against Householder and some aides. Republican Nino Vitale of Urbana wasn't around for Householder's first speakership, but he was an early supporter, calling Householder honest and efficient. And Vitale says the Rosenberger probe is a lot more concerning to him than what happened a decade ago.
We still have an open investigation going on with previous leaders in the State House, including some people who may still be sitting in their chairs that were part of certain dealings. And I think we all need to be very careful of that.
Householder won his seat in 2018 with nearly 70% of his district's vote, so it's possible he could end up serving as Speaker for the next 6 years, till term limits oust him again. Karen Kassler at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the third week of deep winter and the second week of the squashy Osage moon. It's the final week of the sun in Capricorn. Sometimes the last days of deep winter carry a great thaw. One day I went out to the river in the warmth of such a thaw, when cumulus clouds were speeding across the sky in gusts of the southwest wind, and the water was shining with low, brisk waves of silvers and blues and grays. The oaks of the far bank were black against the bright sky, and up the hill patches of yellow Osage glowed like the flush of expanding spring buds. Below the trees, hardy green chickweed and wild onion and henbit and hemlock lay akimbo across the melting snow, and crows were calling from beyond the road. The river had flooded earlier in the week. Mounds and drifts of silt and sand followed the course of the flood along the paths. In the bottom land, the high water had uncovered foliage of buttercups and ragwort and sweet rockets. In the swamp, fat skunk cabbage curled above the mud, many plants open and blooming. Broken white stalks of last May's angelica crunched under my feet as I picked my way across the wetland. The rivulets that passed through the grassy bogs were full and fast. I saw fingerlings swimming in one stream, and I surprised a water strider besides watercress and duckweed in the eddy of a brook. Climbing to the top of the hill above me, I saw the river and its tributaries become paths of light. Then, in a cloud of fog, the brilliant curves disappeared, hidden from winter in misty promises of the thaw. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the transition week to late winter and the third week of the squashy Osage moon. In the meantime, walk in the thaw when it arrives. It's coming soon.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958, thanks to generous listeners like you. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back with more next Sunday morning at 10. Next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with The Book Nook.